Welcome to Wednesday, the 17th of May. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you're here. And join us on Twitter at KUOW. The future of parking is we don't need parking. We're going to talk about that later this hour. Also, comedian W. Kamau Bell is about to call Seattle a borough of San Francisco. We will put that comment in context for you and see if it still makes you mad. And with me today is from Crosscut, the Mossback columnist, Knut Berger. Knut, good to see you today.
Good to see you, Bill.
I wanted to talk to you about what's going on in the news, what's going on in our Puget Sound world, and just get some reaction here, starting with the fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee says it wants to talk to James Comey, the former FBI director. The committee today asked Comey to appear in open and closed sessions. They're asking the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, to give him any notes that Comey might have made of discussions he had with Trump or the White House or the Justice Department about the Russian meddling. And remember, Trump asked James Comey to drop the Bureau's investigation of the White House National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, according to a memo that Comey says he wrote at the time. What's your reaction to all of this, Knut?
Well, it's kind of like the you know, how many impeachable offenses can you produce in an hour?
You went right to the I word.
Yeah, well, it reminds me a lot, of course, of Watergate, which was the big story in journalism when I was
You went college. Right to the W word.
Yeah, it went right to the W word. Yeah, mm-hmm. And you know, it's not the exact thing, but it's the closest parallel that we've had since then, and I think a lot of journalists of my age sort of came of age in that period, and the parallels in many respects are very striking. You know, there's always going to be a lot more to dig out. I mean, we have these allegations. We have nobody's actually read the Comey memo. Congress is going to be looking into it. But the sequence of things has that feeling of, you know, one thing after another. And I was talking with a longtime Republican who happened to be a heroic figure in Watergate who was saying that he, you know.
I think I know who this is. Lives around here?
He does. He lives around here.
Are we not allowed to say his name?
And
right now?
No, it was Bill Ruckelshaus.
Yes.
And
who resigned after Nixon fired the
Right. He was
counsel.
One of the figures in the Saturday Night Massacre. And this was before the Comey thing. I was talking to him a couple weeks ago and I asked him, you know, how he was. And he said, well, the frustrating thing is that a new outrage comes along before I'm done being outraged about the previous outrage. Mm. It's like outrage interruptus.
So frustrating. Really,
yeah, it was very frustrating for him.
You want to? Yeah, go on.
No, we're in that kind of news cycle where, you know, there's kind of a fire hose of events, allegations, revelations, and that kind of thing. And that's one of the ways in which it's very Watergate-like.
Yes. You weren't the only one going to the W word. It's significant when it's a Republican saying it. This is John McCain.
I think it's reaching the point where it's of Watergate size and scale and a couple of other scandals that you and I have seen. It's a centipede that the shoe continues to drop.
A centipede with shoes. That's Senator John McCain of Arizona. Also, a Democrat in Congress, Al Green of Texas, used the I word.
I rise today, Mr. Speaker, to call for the impeachment of the President of the United States of America for obstruction of justice.
You were telling me, Knut, that impeachment talk is a little premature, but there is an amendment that we might not know about, the 25th.
Yeah, well, I thought that was interesting. Last couple of days, a number of conservative columnists have been debating, one in the New York Times was saying, well, don't impeach the guy. He's clearly incompetent. We could possibly remove President Trump under the 25th Amendment, which basically says he's incapacitated. Now, his argument was this is a man-child. This is somebody who's not mature enough to handle these decisions. He was rebutted by another conservative in the Washington Post today who was saying, oh, that's like the worst idea ever. Don't medicalize stupidity. Mm. and that you don't have to have committed a crime to be qualify for impeachment. The problem is the Republicans hold all the cards when it comes to deciding who gets impeached and whatnot. They control Congress. And so you would have to have the House of Representatives vote articles of impeachment. And then you'd have to have the Republican Senate actually try the president. So that's very unlikely.
Let's give the president the last word today, advising graduates as commencement speaker for the Coast Guard Academy.
Look at the way I've been treated lately, especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly. You can't let them get you down. You can't let the critics and the naysayers get in the way of your dreams.
And then he said, have a wonderful life or something like that. Have a terrific life. That's his college advice.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. I think Caligula and Nero might disagree with him on the
PR, Abraham Lincoln.
On the PR front. Yeah, well, yeah, Abraham Lincoln. I mean, you know, when Trump starts giving you a history lesson, it's always, you know, it's always fascinating. I mean, he was... History, I think, began on Inauguration Day, and he keeps making these comments about, why did we fight that Civil War? And why couldn't we have? So he just doesn't know his history. And there's sort of two answers to his question. One is that he hasn't been treated worse than other presidents. And if you go back and look at what people said about Lincoln, Roosevelt, John Adams, even, I mean, who was also thought to be mentally ill. You know, a lot of terrible things have been said. The other thing is, if he thinks he's been treated the worst, maybe it's because he is.
We're going to talk in a few minutes about how history is treating Confederate figures in New Orleans, where monuments are coming down, and how history ought to treat the namesake of the state of Washington, president and slaveholder George Washington. So that's a discussion we'll have. We'll talk with a professor in New Orleans in about 5 minutes, 10 minutes or so later this afternoon. And, well, we've got a lot to talk about. Let's talk about another leader, Justin Trudeau, in a moment. I'm here with the Mossback Crosscut columnist Canute Berger. I'm Bill Radke. You can join us at KUOW. And as I mentioned earlier, we'd like to know, because there's in about a month and a half, there's going to be a new distracted driving law. You can barely touch your cell phone anymore starting in mid-July. We'd like to know how you use, be true now, how you really use your gadget while you're driving. So that's coming up. First of all, you have never been closer to Justin Trudeau, Canada's prime minister, in town today and tomorrow. And here's his countryman to tell you why, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Good to talk with you, Vaughn.
Good to talk to you, Bill. I see our prime minister described as a heartthrob in the Seattle Times today. Is that the general view in Washington State?
I think there's a lot of heartthrob love for Trudeau. So frustrating then for those throbbing that he's not doing any public events. This is all private stuff.
No selfies on this trip, apparently, unless he's got. Let's see, Microsoft CEO summit is he speaking to them this afternoon at 4:30, and I think that's closed anyway.
Yeah, that's in Redmond, other campus.
And then
there.
He goes to the Canadian Consulate, which is right in downtown Seattle, right there on the streetcar line.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going there, and he's meeting with the governor, but I think that's a closed-door meeting as well. But you never know with Justin Trudeau. He may find some time to wander around outside Pike Market or something like that. I'm just guessing. You never know with him. He is somewhat photogenic, as we note.
What does he want to, what's the prime thing he wants to accomplish by coming to the Seattle area?
This is a pretty big part of the Canadian government strategy for dealing with the threat of U.S. protectionism under President Trump, which is trying very, very hard to build trade ties, innovation ties, investment ties with other jurisdictions in the United States. So you go to a state where you think you might be friendly, Canada trades a lot with Washington State. Seattle and Vancouver are not quite sister cities. They can be rivals on some things, but there is a proposal for what is called the Cascadia Innovation Corridor to develop high-tech industry, biological sciences, education, and a high-speed rail line linking the two cities. So I think that'll all be on the agenda for the meeting with the governor. I expect our prime minister will be singing the praises of innovation and investment as well at Microsoft today.
Yeah, what does he want Microsoft to know? Why is he making that visit?
Well, it's interesting. I see the agenda for this Microsoft conference is cybersecurity. That's kind of timely, given what's been going on with this ransomware around the world. But
right. For those who don't know,
Microsoft,
that's the malware attack where big, huge institutions around the world, Russia, China, Europe especially, get their computers locked up, and then they say, the hackers say, if you want your files, give us $300 in Bitcoin.
Yeah, and Microsoft's invested some money in a research center in Vancouver. Bill Gates spoke at the first Cascadia Innovation Conference there last fall. So our prime minister is going down there to do the same kind of thing. And again, it's trade relations, investment, entrepreneurship, but it's also trying to make friends south of the border, because we're more than passing anxious about Donald Trump. Not, of course, that Americans aren't as well. I was just listening to your discussion there.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, okay, well, we've got 2 days with Trudeau, meeting with our governor, meeting at the CEO summit in Redmond, and what do you make of the whole thing? And I should also ask you for an update on your own non-British Columbia's election.
Why isn't the Premier of British Columbia attending this thing?
Right.
It's because we're not sure we have one at the moment. We had an election last week. We have a caretaker premier, Christy Clark, at the moment, but we're still waiting for the final count of ballots. We should know end of next week whether Clark is back with a bare-bones majority in the legislature, or whether we're looking at a change of government to opposition leader John Horgan of the New Democrats, or maybe even a coalition, including one of those, and the leader of the Green Party here, Andrew Weaver. So everything's kind of up in the air at the moment. We're a bit distracted. I hope by next week I can tell you who for sure is the next premier of British Columbia.
Okay, he's up in the air now. He'll be back on the ground with us again in a week. That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Good to talk with you, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
As I said in the news today in New Orleans, Confederate monuments continue to come down. We'll be talking about that this hour on KUOW's The Record, because meanwhile, the state of Washington is named after a slaveholder. So how do we treat monuments here, like the statue of George Washington on the UW campus? I asked Jesse Jackson about that a few months ago. I'll ask a Southern University political science professor in New Orleans who's watching those monuments come down and the protests come up. All that's coming up on KUOW. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke with the Mossback crosscut columnist Knute Berger. Talking now about the fact that the laws on driving with a cell phone are about to change, because the governor signed a new law yesterday, Knute. Right now, you know, you can't text while you're driving. You can't hold the phone to your ear while you're driving. But starting in mid-July, you can't hold the phone at all, really. You can't read your email. You can't hold the phone and dictate a text. You can't check Facebook. Even if you're stopped in traffic, even if the light is red, what's your reaction?
Well, I'm already trying to be a good, better citizen, let us say.
Yeah, you're an offender?
Well, yes.
Me too, brother.
I don't text while dry. I don't try. I can't text. I'm of the generation where my thumbs, you know, don't really work very well.
Oh, so sorry.
I'd have to take both hands off the wheel.
Uh-huh.
But I am guilty of checking my email and checking Twitter and whatnot if I'm at a light.
Yeah.
You know, or if I'm backed up in traffic at a traffic jam. And, you know, we've gotten addicted to this technology, right?
Yes.
I mean, just on.
By the way, you and I both know that it's dangerous.
Yes.
We know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We do. And, you know, but you see people doing it much more egregiously than you would ever do.
Of course. They're doing it wrong.
they're breaking the law all wrong.
Yeah.
But, you know, part of it is just breaking your habit of the constant need. And I realized how intense that was. Just on Monday, I went off to some meetings and realized when I was like halfway there that I'd forgotten my phone.
Yes.
In the recharger. And I was telling people at work, I said, God, it's like I'm back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have my
with 2017 traffic.
Yeah.
I'm spending that much more time in the car.
Yeah.
Now, this new law does allow, quote, the minimal use of a finger, which is a good feature in any law, I think. You can turn on your GPS. You can't enter in an address. I guess you can't zoom out on the view. So it's, you know, I know I dictate my text, but if I'm going to be late, I'll tell my wife, my child caregiver, or what, but I guess I don't think I can do that because I have to, I talk it. And then with my head, you know, little microphone, and then I hit send, which I don't think you can do.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't think this is going to stop the behavior. It might make people, well, it'll make people more conscious of it. But I mean, as you say, you can't talk with a phone in your ear. How many people do you see in
any
given
trip
where people are just blabbing away on the phone? And, you know, so it's and not all of us. I know this is a big revelation, but, you know, not all of us obey 100% of the traffic laws 100% of the time.
Right. You speed a little bit.
I think, you know, I was hearing about this device where people are talking about having it easier for law enforcement to check whether or not you were texting if you've had an accident, where they can, like, access your phone.
Yeah.
And kind of a, you know, and it's like a breathalyzer.
A textalizer? Oh,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. To sort of find out. I also find that pretty intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, ooh, wait, you know, do I really want to, you know, not have my insurance cover an accident because I was doing something like that? So
I think Sound Transit is in on this because I think this law is going to, probably for the better, it might turn me into a more of a mass transit user because the traffic is so bad, you spend so much time. Yeah, it would be inconvenient for me personally. It would take me more time to get where I'm going, sorry to say. Maybe it starts to get worth it. Otherwise, I'm leaving for work at 5:45 in the morning.
Well, and a smartphone is almost a necessity on the bus nowadays because if you're the only guy sitting there without looking at a screen,
What's wrong with you?
Weird, yeah. I mean, you're sitting in the back of the bus, and there are like 40 people all looking at a screen, and then there's just you. You know.
On Twitter, a listener told us they've seen a woman speeding along 520 while eating her lunch with chopsticks. Now, I think I know people who are better with chopsticks than with anything else, but there is going to be a change in the law, in this new law, because if it includes other kinds of distracted driving. So if an officer stops you for swerving and it turns out you swerved because you were eating or restraining your dog, that's an extra $100 fine under this new law. So we want to hear from you. Fess up, as Knut and I just did. When have you been guilty of distracted driving? What were you doing and why? Will this law change your behavior? Knut is skeptical. We'd like to hear your distracted driving stories. So leave us a message, 206-221-3663, 221-3663. Finally, on Facebook, Chris says, I once passed a person on the freeway shaving with a wet razor. That's tip of the hat. I haven't done dry. Yes, I have done that too, but I'm not at that person's level. A backward congratulations to that lawbreaker. Change your ways. It is 12:26, and we're going to be right back. Okay, let's turn now to New Orleans, where the news happening these last few days, you've probably heard about this. There's Confederate monuments coming down and a debate over how we ought to publicly mark ugly chapters in American history. And it's not just New Orleans. We're asking the question here as well. I'm Bill Radke with Crosscut columnist Knut Berger sitting in with me today. New Orleans has taken down two of these monuments. The third, I believe, just came down. And there's another one on the way. And this is Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee and a Confederate general. And there's I think they call it a Liberty Monument or something. And this is so touchy down there that contractors have been working at night and they've been doing it in masks and wearing flak jackets. To people who want the statues to stay, they stand for heritage and culture. To other people who want to see them go, these are just monuments to white supremacy. So how do we remember people from the wrong side of history? Where's the right place to do it? And should more statues fall? Let's ask someone who helped push New Orleans to take those Confederate statues down. This is Malcolm Suber with Take 'em Down NOLA. as in New Orleans, Louisiana. He's an adjunct professor at Southern University in political science. Welcome to KUOW.
Thanks.
Will you remind us why these four statues had to go?
Well, these statues are representative of the white supremacist control of public spaces that obtained in New Orleans since Reconstruction days. And these statues were put up during the Jim Crow period by the descendants of the slave owners to reinforce the fact that they were in control of the city. And so there has been a decades-long struggle by the black community in New Orleans. And so it finally came to fruition around the Black Lives Matter movement and, of course, the shooting in Charleston when the mayor then proposed that the city get rid of four of these most prominent Confederate monuments.
Why do you think these monuments are so meaningful to the New Orleanians who are right now protesting their loss?
Family connections. These people's grandparents were these slave owners. These people's grandparents gave money to put these statues up, and so they are defending their family honor to them. And have no regard for the insults that is felt by the black people and progressive people who see these statues as representative of white supremacy.
Professor, I'm talking to you from Seattle, Washington, which is next door to the campus of the University of Washington, where there's a 14-foot-tall statue of George Washington on a 28-foot pedestal. Founding father, first U.S. president.
And slave owner.
And slave owner.
Right.
And this is a more difficult conversation here in Washington because obviously Jefferson Davis is not the same as George Washington, but George Washington held slaves, period. Should the UW take that statue down?
Personally, for me, I would be in favor of taking down and removing him from a place of prominence. But I do understand that the man had more than one role. And for some people, that's important. But for us here in the South, who lived through enslavement, who have lived with the consequences of discrimination and repression on the part of white supremacists, this is something that touches us to the core. And so it may not touch people in the state of Washington to the core as it is touching us. So for here, for us down here, Washington is part of that hated slave-owning class. And we don't want any reminders of this slave-owning class to be present on our public lands.
I asked civil rights leader Jesse Jackson about this when he was in Seattle, and he was in favor not so much of taking the George Washington statue in Seattle down, but adding a plaque to it.
At least educate people as to who this guy was, you know? Now, in some instances, people want to pull the statues down. Some other instances, people want to preserve the statue and, in fact, inscribe the character. It's the tension of our times, still learning how to live together.
George Washington, first president of the United States, slave master on the statue.
Yeah. At least you know where he is.
What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, that was one of the solutions that was offered here. But, you know, again, it has to do with who owns the public squares and who should control what is presented on these public squares. And if our sentiments today are different than sentiments when these things were erected, then we have to do a historical corrective and remove these things. Certainly a plaque would add some truth to all the myths around Washington. And that might be satisfactory for people in the state of Washington and at Washington University. Whereas for us down here in New Orleans, that won't fly.
We could take this a little farther, I suppose, and consider, do you think there ought to be a University of Washington or a Washington State?
Well, I mean, that's a tall order. And, of course, we got all kinds of places named Columbus and Columbia. So, you know, we got a lot of historical correcting to do. The main thing, I think, is what are we teaching our children? Are we teaching them the truth about American history? And if that story is corrected, then I think that these statues can be seen in the correct light.
One more question, Professor. When we erase a marker of history, take down a monument, for example, as is happening in your city, do we forget our history a little bit?
Well, I mean, most people don't understand what these statues are there for anyway. And these statues have meaning to people who put them up. For other people, it don't have very much meaning except that's some muckety-muck that somebody wants to honor. And so the question is, what are we teaching our children in terms of how this country evolved, the struggles that people have been waging to make this country a free and democratic society? And those are the valuable lessons that can't be represented by either maintaining these statues or removing them. But certainly if anyone is insulted by their presence, we should be magnanimous enough to get rid of them so that they won't irritate people.
Southern University political science professor Malcolm Suber with the group Take 'Em Down NOLA, talking with us from New Orleans, where those Confederate monuments are coming down. Professor, thank you for this.
Thank you.
And I'm Bill Radke, listening to that, along with you and Crosscut columnist Knute Bergers, listening with us too today. And Knute, you've researched this subject, the memorials, the historical markers we have in Seattle and Washington.
Yeah, I have. It's really interesting. And I think the professor made a really great point, which is people often don't know the origins. Like, you know, so, for example, we had plaques on either end of Highway 99 declaring it the Jefferson Davis Memorial Highway. And this became a controversy in the early 2000s when a legislator said, hey, what the heck, and proposed undesignating Highway 9. Now, hardly anybody knew that designation existed. Mm-hmm. There were these two, you know, metal plaques. People got really outraged. Talk radio went crazy over the sort of censorship. Well, it turns out those plaques were put there with the sanction of the state by the Daughters of the Confederacy in the 1930s. And one of the things that we know is from the World War I era to World War II in that period, the Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow and a lot of these things were resurgent, as was this embrace of Confederate heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't just pop up because a mass number of people in Washington thought this was a great idea.
Yeah.
It came up because the Daughters of the Confederacy had a very persistent advocacy group. And, you know, this is the period of the Klan revival and other things. So they're very much a part of an effort. And that's part of the history that you don't ever hear about. Those plaques were removed. One of them is in private hands, and a man has a park on I-5 that you drive by with the Jefferson Davis plaque, and he's flying the Confederate flag. It's his land. He can do what he wants. He's got free speech. But now, you know, the state of Washington is no longer associated with these things. We have a lot of place names in the Northwest. I've written a lot about that are racist or considered offensive. We had, three place names down on the Columbia River named Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
We've had others, Native American terms like squaw, that are considered very offensive. And slowly but surely, people in those local areas are proposing new names and changes, and those are being done. And I think we gain more history by at least going through the debate than we lose by making a change, especially when we understand what was done and where it came from.
What do you think is the future of, let's just start small, not so small, that statue of George Washington, not far from where we're sitting right now? What do you think?
Well, that'll be really interesting because the argument about, and I've written about, whether Washington State should change its name. The city of San Francisco has a high school named after George Washington. They're talking about changing its name. We also have counties named after Thomas Jefferson or mm-hmm. People who certainly weren't anti-slavery, Franklin Pierce. You can go back through history and sort of, pick at all the politically incorrect or whatever. But I think, the feedback I got when I brought up this issue of Washington State was a lot of people felt that if that yes, George Washington was a slave owner, that was not good, but he was also the sort of father of our country, the first president, the person who largely responsible for winning the Revolutionary War. I mean, they're sort of saying on balance, he's still worthy of recognition.
How about recognition in a history textbook and not as a statue, which has the connotation of right. almost worshipful.
Right. Well, it just depends on how far you want to go. I mean, so Seattle, we came of age in an era when big, you know, kind of statues of, quote, great men were sort of just on the way out.
Mm.
So we have this kind of weird assortment of major statues. And some of those people are of questionable character, or they're just kind of obscure. I mean, John McGraw is like the centerpiece statue down by, you know, Olive, by the monorail there. Nobody remembers who he was, and the Chamber of Commerce put that statue up years ago. We have Chief Seattle, who I don't think anybody would argue is, you know, a significant local figure. We have William Henry Seward at Volunteer Park. What was he known for? Well, you know, he was a Manifest Destiny guy, and we purchased Alaska.
Yes. Okay. Finally, should UW take down that George Washington statue, yes or no, or add a plaque, or what do you think?
I think the idea on that, in that particular case, I think the idea of adding context like Jesse Jackson recommended is probably a really good idea.
It's the Mossback Crosscut columnist Knute Berger, and we are going to talk about the latest in the campaign for the mayor of Seattle and what Ed Murray can and can't do while he's still in office and the future of parking and more. Stay tuned. Okay, on KOW's The Record, let's catch you up on Seattle Mayor. Yesterday, Seattle's Ethics and Elections Commission said Murray's supporters, Ed Murray, you know, he said he's not running for re-election. He's fighting this lawsuit from a man who says that Murray sexually abused him as a teenager in the 80s. Murray denies that allegation completely. Murray's supporters want to set up a legal defense fund for him because he'll spend $1 million maybe fighting this lawsuit. This legal defense fund would be run independently from the mayor. Donations would be anonymous. Donors would sign confidentiality agreements. The contributions would be unlimited. And Knute, the Ethics and Elections Committee, I guess they can't say no. They issued an advisory opinion saying, no, this is not okay.
Yeah, I mean, basically what they're saying, there's no provision that allows for this. So unless the city council, somebody creates a provision that says what the ground rules are for doing such a thing. And you can see politically it's very fraught. I mean, if you have a sitting mayor getting anonymous donations to help him with a legal issue or any other issue.
But if they're anonymous, what's the problem?
Well, I think because then you don't know who is having undue influence on the mayor.
So the mayor might know who's contributing, even if no one else does.
Yeah, or other people in the community. I mean, word gets around. It's not like it's a town that people don't talk and that kind of thing. So, and it's the opposite of transparency, which is something I think the government alleges to value. We're supposed to be increasing transparency, not reducing it. So, but I also understand the dilemma that Ed Murray has. It's not like he makes so much money as mayor that $1 million in legal bills is going to be easy to pay. And even after he's out of office, we don't really have a history of our former mayors stepping into high paying corporate jobs. It's not a. So I certainly understand. And one way to get around it would be if he resigned. And then set up a legal defense fund. Mm. So it was a private
You think that
citizen.
Might happen?
Oh, I have no idea. But that would be one way. On the other hand, I think that would probably not be acceptable to the mayor, just in the sense that he has a lot he wants to accomplish yet. And he believes and is arguing in his absolute innocence. So, not running for reelection has been, a major blow to him. And I can understand why he might not want to take that step. But
So Ed Murray is not running for mayor. Everybody else is. It's 14 candidates now, something like that. At least
I've lost count, and there's still a couple of days to go.
Right? That's right, till Friday. Is there a front runner? Do you think?
Well, I think there probably is. I mean, we'll see. But I think Jenny Durkin got into the race, and I think she is seen as somebody who's acceptable to a wide swath of Democrats in Seattle.
Former U.S. attorney.
Former U.S. attorney.
Why is she considered friendly to the business establishment or something? I've heard that. Why is that?
Well, it's partly because sort of association, probably things that she's telling people privately. Mm. I think they see her as somebody who's highly professional, very respected through her legal work. She's well known within political circles, and she appeals to a lot of the people in the mayor's coalition. They want somebody that they can deal with, somebody who's, mature. They don't want another activist like Mike McGinn or somebody even further, to the left. So she seems, I think, like a very safe bet. The fact that she's a woman, I think, is also a big plus for her. But, with candidates like that, they have to run for something. You know what I mean? I mean, we don't know what kind of a candidate she's really going to be. So. Yeah. We'll find out.
Crosscut, your magazine ran a piece, because there's so many candidates. The piece was, congratulations, you're thinking of running for mayor. We don't have time to cover all the campaign announcements, so please just fill in the blanks. And they just wrote out the boilerplate announcement, which is, and then they tell you to fill in an adverb here and there. So it says, I stand, well, you can fill in your own. What would you say, Canute? I stand.
Mossily
here before you with.
Carol,
my husband, wife, partner, lover of
many years,
to announce my candidacy for mayor of Seattle. I, Canute Berger, chose here,
Dick's Drive-In,
because as a
strange
child in Seattle, I first
gorged on cheap burgers
right here at Dick's. It was here where I first fell in love with Seattle's land and its people. This is the
smuggest
city in the world. Where else can you see
Green Lake
and
the Cascades
and
the Milk Carton Derby?
The Milk Carton Derby in one day, plus the
sun
keeps us
unhappy.
And we have to be unhappy these days, because with the rising cost of
soda pop,
the terrible problem with
homelessness,
and the fight for
the $15 an hour,
we do have problems in this
depressing city.
We, with me as your mayor, Canute Berger, with my years of experience as a
columnist.
We are going to fight for this city's most
depressed
citizens, and we are going to do it together. Go!
Puget Sound Croquet Club.
You are a shoo-in. Hey, with this many candidates, it only takes like 20 votes to make it to the general election, right? It's going to be a split vote.
I've been telling people that, there isn't just a mayor's election. There are two.
Yes.
One is the primary. And I went back and was looking at some figures. And, basically, you can be the front runner if you get 28% of the vote.
There you go.
And it's a much smaller vote than usual. So it's going to be who gets in that 25% to 30% bracket.
August 1st is the primary. Top two vote getters go to the general election November 7th. More of KUOW's The Record with Bill Radke and Canute Berger, Mayor Canute Berger, mayor to be, mayor's candidate, just announced. Canute Berger coming up. This is KUOW's The Record. W. Kamau Bell grew up listening to his mom talk about what it meant to be black in America. And for a long time, he rolled his eyes at her stories about being treated as less than, as suspect. He thought, things aren't like that anymore. Then when he was 15, at his favorite record store in Chicago, an employee started following him around, accusing him of shoplifting.
And then he proceeded to walk me down the stairs, grab me by the back of my coat, and basically, like Will Smith, DJ Jazzy Jeff, throw me out the front door, except I didn't think it was funny. And then I suddenly found myself standing outside the store, afraid to go back inside to get my friend Rob, because I was, at that point, afraid of power and authority. Then finally, my friend Rob walked outside, and here I am, a 15-year-old, 6-foot, 150-pound black dude, trying to be tough in the world. And I start crying on the sidewalk of this record store in Chicago.
Today, Kamau talks about race and racism as much as he can in his stand-up, on the three podcasts he co-hosts, and on the show he hosts for CNN. It's called The United Shades of America. On that show, Kamau makes a point of having difficult conversations. On one episode about immigration, he talked with avowed white supremacist Richard Spencer, and he got a ton of criticism on Twitter for doing that. People said he gave a national platform to a person with a disgusting racist philosophy. Well, W. Kamau Bell told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel that his critics are missing the point.
I mean, you can have a problem with it. You feel free to have a problem with whatever you want to have a problem with. You know, I'm not trying to say you can't be offended, but I am saying that you're revealing yourself when you just focus on him. That either means, and this is true of most people, you didn't see it. So you saw like the commercial or you saw the clip online, but you didn't see the whole episode. And in your mind, you've turned it into Kamau sits down with Richard Spencer for an hour and laughs along the whole time, which I don't even necessarily think that's a bad thing, but that's not what happened. And two, there were so many. I got really frustrated for the other people in that episode. So if you did see it, you then ignored all the incredible stories of people who do need to be uplifted, of people you do need to be talking about on Twitter, of articles you should be sharing, of campaigns people are raising money for. All those other people we talked to in that episode, all the way from the mayor of Gaithersburg, who's a white guy who looks like he could be at Richard Spencer's family reunion, but is the mayor of the most diverse town in America and happily there and wants it to be, is happy about it, all the way to like IO Spaces, which is a business incubator for African immigrants, all the way to Ruby Corrado, who's a refugee who came to this country, who is helping other LGBT refugees, you know, find a safe space, you know, all the way to Sarah Zulu, who's doing a refugee thing. There's all these people in the episode whose stories you could be talking about, but you're focusing on Richard Spencer saying, I'm giving white supremacy a platform, when it's like, you can't not give it a platform. You can't, like, you can't even see through it. You say, oh, I'm focused on white supremacy. You're focused on white supremacy. I thought it just felt so ridiculous to me. It also felt insulting to all the other people in the episode.
Well, since you've been doing this show, where you make a point to have these difficult conversations, to meet people and highlight their stories, what surprised you the most?
You know, people know how to talk about their lives, and people who are experiencing trauma or who are the victims of violence or people who are living under, you know, oppressive regimes. And I would say for a lot of people in this country right now, they feel like they're living under a repressive regime, have the answers. They just don't have the resources to make those answers come to fruition. You know, when you talk to gang members on the south side of Chicago about this life, not one of them was like, I'm a gangster. I love it. I'm in a gang. I'm loving this life. And we talked to lots of different ones. I'm not saying those guys don't exist, but we also talked to guys who are older for the most part, too. So maybe they were like that when they were younger. But there's a sense of, like, when the media reports on violence in Chicago, they're sort of reporting on it like everybody is Ice Cube's character from Boys in the Hood walking up to people with a gun in their waist going, we got a problem here? And for the most part, these guys are like, we get guns because we feel like we need to protect ourselves because we do not have proper police protection. Our public housing has been destroyed, so we've all been moved into neighborhoods that we're not from, which makes people feel threatened because we come from other parts of town and they don't know us. So suddenly they feel threatened, we feel threatened, so we're carrying guns. And also, if you just take a walk around the south and west side of Chicago, which I would guess that the mayor of Chicago probably hasn't done that often, and if he has, he wasn't really looking around. It's acres and acres of undeveloped land. So if you're 13 or 14 or 15 at the age where you're like, I'm going to get a part-time job after school, there's no jobs. And if there's no part-time jobs for 13-year-olds, there's no full-time jobs for their parents. Like, there's just, and I'm just saying, just look at the, there's acres and acres of undeveloped land. So I feel like they're like, we need jobs and better schools and better police protection. Well, though, yeah, those are the solutions, but they can't make them happen without the support of their local government. And so I feel like same thing in Appalachia, same thing talking to refugees. You know, they're just like, refugees, I just want a chance. I'm not saying give me anything. Just give me a chance. You know, and all these people have the solutions. They just need to be supported by people who can help them bring those to fruition.
Well, you're headed here to Seattle, and you've been here before, yes?
Oh, yeah. I think I initially went there because Hari, the co-host of Politically Reactive, and I think he's probably at least the deputy mayor of Seattle. I don't know how it works.
Yes.
But he is always like, you got to go to Seattle. You got to go to Seattle. So I first started going there a lot with him, and then I fell in love with the place like he does, although I'm not talking about moving there. And so, you know, I'm a big fan of Seattle. Coming from the Bay Area, there seems like there should be some sort of bullet train between, you know, the Bay Area and Seattle. It seems like another borough of the Bay Area, maybe.
So, I think people in Seattle would take issue with that.
Well, they take issue with a lot of things.
That's not an unfair point.
I don't mean that they're I'm not trying to say they're not their own independent place. I'm just saying we all get along very well. But I also know that they also have a chip on their shoulder about being compared to the Bay Area. The way I've said it is like, it's like, to me, when I walk around Seattle, it feels like probably San Francisco 1978. That's how I feel about it. So the fonts on the buildings look like, is this old school?
Okay. Well, I'm sure that people who come to your show at the Neptune will have something to say about that to you. You may well be hearing from them.
Yes. But, come live to tell me I'm wrong about feeling like the Bay Area and Seattle have something in common. Yes. Let's focus on that, the left.
Yes. Well, I did want to ask, in Seattle proper anyway, it's a largely white city, and most of the people you run into who are white feel like, we're really progressive and we don't have a problem with race here and it's not really an issue. So what do those conversations look like? I mean, when you're getting up on stage at the Neptune on Saturday, how do you have those conversations with a largely white audience that's going to be like, I don't see it. We're super progressive here. We don't have a race problem.
I mean, yeah, I think most of the stuff I do is about, first of all, eliminating this left-right thing that we found out in the election doesn't really fit anymore. So if I'm going to talk about America's failures, it's like we're not going to talk about it from the right versus the left for the most part. I'll do some of that. But really, it's about how many of us aren't doing enough. And a lot of it is about how white people are not using their white privilege effectively. And that's all white people, people who voted for Trump, people who didn't vote for Trump. So it's like people who voted for Hillary, people who voted for Bernie, people who voted for Jill, people who voted for the Peace and Freedom Party, that forget your, okay, there's your political leanings, but also just use your white privilege to help people. You know, I feel like most white people are like Clark Kent walking around pretending not to be Superman. Like, cape up, man. Like, you know, sort of like do something. Don't pretend like, I wish Superman was here. He's here. He's you. Get out there. And I feel like that's a conversation white people on the left, white people on the left. The funny thing about Richard Spencer, and he said this in the interview, I just want white people to be as smart about race as black people are. And I was like, and I laughed because I was like, oh, we'd love to help you with that. Now, I think we're both defining smart in different ways, but I agree with him. I don't think white people, certainly on the left, are not as smart about race as people of color are. And worse, I think the white people who are the alt-right and the white supremacists in this country, they're sort of using their whiteness for their evil purposes. And then white people on the left are like, I don't really think of myself as white. I think I'm really kind of a mutt. I'm Italian and German and Irish. That's all white people. So yeah, for me, it's like about challenging them to, you know, up you whitey race. You will accomplish what you will, to ruin a quote from Marcus Garvey.
That's W. Kamau Bell, host of United Shades of America on CNN, host of three podcasts, including Politically Reactive with comedian Hari Kondabolu. Kamau is going to be performing stand-up this Saturday, 8 o'clock, at the Neptune Theater. And, boy, he had some stuff to say about Seattle and San Francisco. Apparently, Knute Berger from Crosscut, Seattle's a borough of the Bay Area.
Well, we have long wanted to be like San Francisco, but no longer.
And he says walking around Seattle is like walking around San Francisco in the 1970s, 71 or something?
Yes, 1978. Well, I lived in San Francisco from 1975 to 77, and no. No, we're really different.
Yeah, but he says you have a chip on your shoulder. He said that too. And if we do, if you have a chip on your shoulder, Knute, I know you're a Seahawks fan. How do you feel about a San Francisco 49er playing quarterback for the Seahawks? Backup quarterback, technically. Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah, right, Colin Kaepernick. Well, you know.
This is the rumor.
That's right. Well, as a football rival, I don't like Colin Kaepernick, but the second he dons a Seahawk jersey, I will be one of his most ardent supporters.
Because as Jerry Seinfeld said, you're rooting for clothes.
That's right.
You're rooting for laundry at this point.
Rooting for laundry, yeah.
The Seahawks defensive lineman Michael Bennett was on the John Clayton Show and was asked whether Kaepernick would be a good fit here in Seattle.
I think he'd be a very good fit in our locker room. I don't know why he wouldn't. I think we all talk about the same issues. It's just that he had the courage to be able to step up and not get it. And I think if you look at the way the world is going, people don't want athletes to start skin up because athletes are the ones who control a lot of the products, who control a lot of the change. So if we start speaking up, then the world's going to be a lot different.
That's Seahawks Michael Bennett. He's referring to Colin Kaepernick being most well-known to a lot of fans for being socially active, for kneeling during the national anthem.
Well, you know, I mean, the Seahawks became famous for hiring misfits. Hiring guys with something to prove, hiring people that you had low expectations of, and then they, and having a locker room full of very unusual individuals. And now that we've won a little bit, everybody's like super conservative. It's like, and not politically, but like, oh God, dude, don't change anything. Don't change the chemistry. Don't change, you know, it's like, that's not what got us here. Change, you know, changing things is what got us here.
Us, he says. That's Crosscut's Knute Berger wearing the laundry of the Seattle Seahawks. Finally, Knute, I've loved having you sitting in and educating us and reacting with us to
glad
the news
to
today. Final thing, you know, that again, we talked about the distracted driving law coming in July. You won't be able to basically hold the phone. Minimal use of a finger is all that's allowed. That's in the law. Which I do like that aspect. It should be in more laws. You can turn on your GPS. You can't enter in an address. It's coming. It's supposed to happen in 2019, but the governor sped it up to July. So we ask you, listeners, to fess up about your distracted driving habits. Really, you seem more interested in tattling. Narissa on Facebook said she'd seen drivers with a laptop open on the dash. Looking at them. Jessica says she saw someone driving about 40 miles an hour on southbound I-5 in the middle lane near Federal Way. She got around to see him, and his head was down. He had a newspaper opened across the steering wheel. You look so blasé, Knute. Like,
newspaper. We need support.
That's right. An independent press is more valuable than ever. The least you can do is to have it on your steering wheel. Carla says, my son saw a guy driving on I-90 playing a guitar and eating cereal. Really? Really, Carla? I guess we have to believe Carla on this one.
I guess so.
It's her world. It's her Facebook post. A friend of KOW, Dee Parvaz, says, I saw a taxi driver eating a bowl of steaming hot soup while negotiating Seattle traffic. Brave and stupid, she says. And finally, props to Patrick, who took us up on the challenge and actually confessed his own distracted driving habits.
I'm a performer in the Seattle area, and often when I am driving into Seattle to like the Fifth Avenue Theater, where I've worked a few times, I have a little piano app open on my phone that, you know, has this, a picture of a piano, all the white keys, all the black keys, and I use it to warm up my voice when I'm driving. So I'm sitting there playing these tiny little notes, trying to hit the right one when I'm warming up and driving on the freeway, which I shouldn't do. I know I shouldn't do it, but and I will do my best to stop, especially in July.
Well, at least it's an important use he's putting that device to.
Playing the piano.
Thanks for listening today. And Knute Berger, thanks for riding along this hour. Yeah. Come back anytime, will you?
You bet.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke, and we'll be back tomorrow here on KUOW Seattle.